CorpoNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, this is Don Bassingthwaite, author of Word of Traitors and Temple of Yellow Skulls, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 151. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I take a back seat while Jeffrey D. Wynn brings you a review of The Legacy of Dakan, an Eberron trilogy by Don Bassingthwaite. He follows that up with an interview with the author. But before I let Jeffrey take it away, I have two things to mention. First, on October 17th, 2010, I will be releasing an interview and review of the novel Gontalgrim by R.A. Salvatore, the new book that just came out a couple of days ago as I record this. And this will be part of the official blog tour promoted by Wizards of the Coast. Along with that, there will be a scavenger hunt where they will be giving away signed copies of the novel, sets of the Red Box, and even paid trips to D&D Experience this year. You can look for that on October 17th in 2010. And let me just give you a hint right now. The sooner you check out that episode on that day, the more likely you'll be able to win a prize. Just saying. When that day comes along, make sure you're checking out thetomeshow.com often to see what the scavenger hunt is, to see if you can win yourself all kinds of freebies. With that done, take it away, Jeffrey. All right, so now I am here with Jeffrey D. Wynn, who's going to tell us a little bit about his thoughts on the trilogy. Can you first of all pronounce the trilogy for me?
The Legacy of Dakan. That's how I say it.
Very good.
So it's a hobgoblin word. It has to have, you know, very hard consonants. Dakan.
All right, almost sounds a little Klingon, doesn't it?
Yeah, kind of.
All right, so what is the Legacy of Dakan all about? What is without spoiling it? What's the general story?
Well, the Legacy of Dakan is actually a sequel trilogy to The Dragon Below. It follows the story of Geth, who is a shifter, one of the sort of half lycanthrope races of Eberron. And in The Dragon Below, he acquires this legendary hobgoblin sword, the Sword of Heroes. And in The Legacy of Dakan, Geth is called to the hobgoblin nation of Dargoon, sort of because of his sword. And he and a bunch of his friends get wrapped up in this sort of political intrigue and sort of chaos that's going on. Let me back up a bit. In the world of Eberron, hobgoblins are a very ancient and proud race. They're sort of like elves in Tolkien. If you can imagine an empire of proud hobgoblin warriors, you know, spanning across an entire continent. You know, that is the ancient history of Eberron. But sort of in modern times, hobgoblins have been reduced to the monsters that we know they are today. But just recently, they've managed to carve out this tiny nation called Dargoon in a part of Eberron, and they're sort of trying to rebuild their culture. So that's where we come into the story. Geth is summoned to Dargoon because they believe that with his sword, the Sword of Heroes, he can use the sword to find another legendary artifact. I believe it's called the Staff of Rulership or something, which the king, Haruk, wants to sort of cement his leadership amongst the other hobgoblin tribes. That's how it starts, but that's not how it ends. It's a very roller coaster story. Stuff happens halfway through the series that drastically changes the direction of the storyline. And I don't want to give anything away, but it is definitely a wild ride, and there are twists and turns, and there are many characters that come and go and have relationships with one another, and it's epic.
Very cool. So you seem to really like the book. What are some of the trilogy? What are some of the aspects of the story that really appeal to you? Is it the characters? Is it the twists and turns? Is it the surprises?
Well, I think the thing that has to be said the most about this trilogy is the way that the author brings the Hobgoblin civilization to life in a way that I have rarely seen in a Dungeons and Dragons novel, whether it's Eberron or Forgotten Realms or Dragonlance or what have you. Don Bassingthwaite really goes out of his way to detail the history of Hobgoblin culture, sort of the internal concepts that drive Hobgoblin culture, how the Hobgoblins relate to one another. There's two very strong concepts that come up again and again in the books, and that's Moot and Atcha. And Moot is sort of this sense of duty. That they're both words for honor, and in the interview you'll hear me ask Don about these. They're both words for Hobgoblin honor, and Moot is one side of it. It's sort of the keeping to one's duty aspect, and Atcha is the doing of great deeds, and these two concepts are sort of both at war with one another, but they hold the society together, and I think it's very ingenious how he has brought this culture to life in a way that I have rarely seen before.
Well, very good. We're going to keep the review portion here pretty short because the interview goes a good 40 or so minutes. Any other things you want to share about this trilogy to let people know about before we toss it on over to you and Don?
I just think that if you read one Eberron trilogy this summer, read The Legacy of Dokkan.
All right, good. So before we head over to the interview with the author Don Bassingthwaite and Jeff Wynn here conducting the questioning, I did want to give my sponsor's pick of the episode. The sponsor in this episode is Noble Knight Games, as it has been for some time now. They continue to support us. And my pick of the episode is going to be Secrets of Sarlona. A book that comes up in the interview. You guys discuss it a little bit for some things that you really liked in it. And it was one of the early reviews that you did in the show, if I recall, Jeff.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
And they've got it at Noble Knight, despite the fact that it is long out of print, originally written for a third edition, although full of content and story ideas that are easily usable for fourth edition. They've got it for $24, and since it originally retailed at $30 and it's out of print and they've got it at mint condition, I think it's a pretty good buy.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, so now I am here with Jeff Wynn and Don Bassingthwaite. I think I said that right.
Yes.
Awesome. And we're going to talk some D&D novels. So I'm going to let Jeff take it away because he's the one, the other Jeff, because he's the one that's read the books. And I'm going to get out of the way and let you guys do your thing.
Okay. Hello, Don, and welcome to the Tome Show.
Hi, thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
I just want to say that it's great to have you on. It's great to be able to talk to you. I have been a fan of Eberron ever since the setting premiered in, what was it, 2003? Who can remember? But I've read just about every single Eberron novel that's come out. And so far to date, I think you with your six books, I think you have written the most out of any single author for this setting. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel pretty good. I feel very privileged to have done that. I think Keith Baker's catching up to me. He's got two books in his new series coming, so he's going to be at five.
But you've still got him beat by one, and
I've still got him beat by one. That's right.
So that's very impressive. Before we get to the main topic, the legacy of Dacon. Let's go back and talk about how this all began with the Dragon Below trilogy. The Dragon Below trilogy came out in 2005, and was one of the earliest Eberron trilogies. Why don't you describe sort of that trilogy, how you created it, and sort of what happened?
Well, what started the trilogy off is I found out that Eberron was coming out, and I talked to, you know, the editor of the line is someone I'd worked before with on the Dark Matter books. And there were some elements in Eberron that really resonated with me. I really liked the place of the aberrations or the aberrants in the whole cosmology. And I wanted to, you know, take that and play with it. This the history and everything. So I got in touch with them and said, you know, can I pitch you a series? There were a couple of trilogies sort of on the books already. And he said, yeah, I'd love to hear something from you. And why don't you look at something sort of in this part of the world? And that part of the world being sort of the Eldian Reach and the Shadow Marches. And I think probably what started off the whole idea behind the trilogy was this idea of a dragon corrupted by the forces of the Far Realm. In Zoriat is the term from Eberron. And it just sort of grew from there. So this is a trilogy where it started off with the villain in mind. And then I sort of built that around and built up the heroes and the storyline. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is really, that's sort of where it started from.
Okay, and I remember reading the Dragon Below trilogy when it first came out, and I was really impressed by the great action, the interaction between the characters, but I think where you really hit your stride is this new trilogy, the Legacy of Dacon. When did you know that you were going to write a second trilogy? Was it before you had finished the first trilogy?
I have to stop and remember now. I think I had finished writing the first trilogy before I picked up the second one. In fact, I'm pretty sure I did, because I had to stop, and when I started the second trilogy, I had to figure out where the characters were and how to bring them together again. But what the story behind that one is, it sort of generated an idea out of Wizards of the Coast. They asked me, would you like to write a second trilogy, and would you like to handle the transition of power into Dacon? Or in Dargoon, the current Hobgoblin kingdom. Go ahead.
when did you know that Geth was going to be the hero of this trilogy, and that his sword was going to play a major part?
That started right from the beginning, because I had. Because I had this, you know, the ancient Hobgoblin sword with him, it was an absolute natural to sort of bring that in and expand on it. I didn't have sort of like the backstory of the sword really. I fleshed it out a certain amount in the first trilogy, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't sort of think about the place of it within the broader Hobgoblin history until I started working on the second trilogy.
And the really amazing thing to me about this trilogy, the Legacy of Dakon, is the way that you have described and detailed this Hobgoblin culture. And there's even seeds of this trilogy throughout the Dragon Below. Not only Geth's sword, but the Grieving Tree. Can you sort of describe how you created this very original fantasy culture and you know, generated all of this detail for it?
I gotta say, I loved working with the Dakani history, the Hobgoblin history. It was just it was so much fun, and I really feel honored to have the Wizards of the Coast let me sort of do what I did with that. It's sort of, I think where it originally grew out of, when you referenced the Grieving Tree, is that Keith Baker created the Durkala, the dirge singers, as sort of the Hobgoblin or the Dakani equivalent of bards. And he specified that they were primarily women. And I thought, well, there was probably sort of a male equivalent. And I decided to make the what if they were sort of the artificers of the culture? And this is the worst part about having written another book in the middle, because I am blanking on the name of the name that I gave to them.
the Dachur, I think, something like that.
Yes, that's it. The Dachur. Anyways, yes. So yeah. And what I wanted to do was, I sort of built it up around that, and the legend, this legendary Dachur who created Geth's sword, created the Grieving Tree, created some other, you know, sort of fantastic artifacts. And yeah. I wanted to be non-human. So I had to sort of play with, you know, the ideas of them. And what you think, how you think about goblins in D&D, and I wanted to sort of put a spin on it, but sort of stay true to it, so that they're primarily, you know, they're not nice people. They're not a nice race.
Right.
And I think that I sort of tried to bring that out in the creation of the Grieving Tree artifact, where one of the things they considered to be like a great cultural achievement was this torture device. And it's like they see nothing wrong with it. And so it sort of skews everything around that. And if you understand what I mean, they come out of sort of a dark and violent and warlike place. And when it came time in the Legacy of Dakon trilogy to work with that, the first thing I did when I sort of created any part of it was think, how would the goblins think of this? How does it fit into a culture that is primarily warlike and primarily hierarchical and, you know, is sort of a very violent and bloody culture?
And that point that you make, that hobgoblins are essentially not nice people, that to me is one of the very interesting things about this trilogy, is that while the heroes are trying to save Dargoon, the question comes up several times: is this culture even worth saving? These are violent, bloody people. Is it even possible for them to have a peaceful society that can coexist with the rest of Eberron? And that's an interesting sort of political, moral, ethical dilemma.
Yeah. One of the things that I liked in the original Eberron campaign setting that really caught my attention was the character of Lesh Haruk, the hobgoblin who sort of betrayed House Dinaith and orchestrated the Hobgoblin uprising and sort of carved out his own nation, and then became sort of the statesman and is trying to build a homeland for his people. And again, yes, this is how does he sort of force his, you know, his various warlords into accepting, you know, it's like, okay, we have to coexist with these nations that are around us. They may not like us. They don't like them, but they're there. They want to survive. And I found it very interesting. It's like not just sort of how he maintains that, but how the person who follows him is going to maintain that. So it's a balance between sort of the future of Dargoon and this glorious past that they have in the Empire of Dakan.
Now you've already mentioned that in the course of the series there is sort of a transition of power in Dargoon, and I won't give away any spoilers, but something very major happens at the end of the first book that sort of changes things very drastically in the world of Eberron. But at the same time, Wizards of the Coast has very publicly said that the novels are not canon, and what happens in the novels won't change the rule books. Is this trilogy? Is anything in this trilogy going to impact the rest of Eberron franchise, whether it's the books, the novels, or video games?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I think I'd like to see some things carried over, probably more in the history than in the present or the future. And I can certainly understand the dilemma that you run into by declaring something canon. It does sort of limit it limits your future products. It limits, you know, probably what people at home, how they want to play the game. But really, I have no problem with them saying, no, the books aren't canon. As long as I like to think of the novels as sort of like their own storyline. So the novels are consistent within themselves. So that another novel might come along. Sorry.
And this is the first time in any Eberron novel that I think I've seen something happen to a major part of the Eberron world. I mean, there have been minor battles. There have been, you know, parts of cities getting damaged. But if this had happened in Forgotten Realms, say this would have been considered, you know, a major event. Did you have to get permission to have the thing that happens at the end of book one? Did you have to get
give me permission? Yes, on. I did. I mean, these in all of the books I've written, not just for Eberron, but other game tie-in novels that I've written in the past, I've gotten used to writing small stories. Things that are not, you know, going to change the greater picture of the setting. And it was a lot of fun to be given the opportunity to do something that is not exactly like a realm shaking event, but you know, it is a continuity event. And when the idea behind the trilogy was proposed to me, the first thing I said was, can I do the thing that happens? And they thought about it and said yes. So I got to run with it from there, and it was a lot of
awesome
fun.
it was definitely I thought the first book was okay up until the end when that thing happens, and then I'm like, okay, now I have to read the rest of this series to find out what happens. So that was really cool. let's talk about the huge cast of characters that you have in this trilogy, because you have a bunch of great heroes and a bunch of really nasty villains.
I love among, my villains.
I love to hate your villains, and every time one of your villains gets what's coming to them, it's like, yes, finally that guy is gone. Because he was annoying.
Thank you. I am flattered.
let's talk about the heroes. On the side of good, we have and let me know if I'm mispronouncing these names. We have Geth, the shifter from the first trilogy. We have Ekkas, the Dur-Kala,
yes.
Hobgoblin.
Yeah.
Ekkas?
Ekkas is how I Ekkas pronounce it.
Okay, Ekkas.
That's how I say it.
The Hobgoblin Bard, who's also sort of a carryover. Ashi.
Yes.
Ashi Dedenith. Which I always trip over Dedenith, because
it sounds like I'm going D apostrophe D.
I'm going to Denny's and gonna get the grand slam. So yes, we have Geth, Ekkas, Ashi, Tenquis.
Tenquis, yes, the tiefling artificer. Tenquis.
Yes, Tenquis. Who among these heroes is sort of your favorite character? Who really stands out to you?
I gotta say Geth. Geth is my favorite. Probably because all three of Geth, Geth, Ekkas, and Ashi have their own story arc within the trilogy. But I've got a soft place for Geth because he's, you know, been carried over between two trilogies. Because he's carried over from the first trilogy to the second trilogy, he's actually, I've seen him through sort of two story arcs. The first one, where he sort of comes to terms with his past in the first trilogy.
Yeah.
And then in the second trilogy, he sort of comes to terms with his present and his future. So, you know, I've got a soft spot for him and the way he's grown. Ekkas and Ashi, I both like them. I think Ashi, I've left her with sort of this is the problem with talking about the trilogies, and you don't want to give spoilers, but I think I've left her in a good place for her future. And Ekkas has got her own thing going on, but definitely Geth is my favorite.
Do you think that Geth could potentially be a breakout character like Drizzt Do'Urden or you know one of those other characters?
I'd like to think that he could. I don't know. The problem is that at the moment, maybe Arve Salvatore's felt this too. I feel like I've told his story at the moment. So I don't know what I would do for an encore with him, but there is that possibility. You could go back and revisit him. And I hope that people like him. Sure. Pardon?
Yeah, totally. Let's talk a bit about Ekkas and Dagi and the concepts of Moot and Acha and all of these goblin concepts that surround their relationship.
I like those too. Thanks for asking about them. The concepts of Moot and Acha they're essentially two terms for goblin honor. Moot is honor by doing your duty, and Acha is honor by doing great deeds. And they sort of came about because I was thinking, okay, what holds goblin society together when you've got this sort of violent culture going on? And so I sort of came up with the idea that there is this force, everyone wants to get ahead, but there's also the force that, you know, you have to do what you're supposed to do, and that you can get ahead just by doing that. But Ekis and Doggy sort of reinforce that. Doggy is very concerned with Moot, the concept of duty. It's not a consumed like obsessively, but it is this, an integral part of his character. Mm-hmm. And Ekis, as the bard and as a member of the of her clan, is the Ketch'Valar, the word bearers. She's concerned with sort of the glory of the past primarily, and part of her story arc is coming to terms with a relationship with Doggy and moving again from the past into the future. And it sort of all involves with it, it revolves, as you say, a bit around those two goblin concepts of doing your duty and doing your honor. Mm-hmm. If that, I hope that explains it.
Was there any inspiration from the real world in these two concepts, or in any part of goblin culture?
There are I've got a background in anthropology, so there are certain things that I picked up and thought, okay, this would make sense. Those particular ones, between Moot and Acha, I can't think of anything particular there, but there are certainly in how Lesh Haruk relates to the warlords who sort of support him. There are real world examples where the leader of a the leader of a tribe or a group of tribes, to sort of show your power, you give stuff away. They sort of redistribute goods. And this is like the concept behind the Northwest Coast potlatches. Sort of simplifying, but this is how he relates. You know, his power derives from sort of sharing out, you know, his influence among the warlords. So he controls them that way. And there are other bits of things sort of through the novels. I have a fondness for telling what my characters are eating. And so I did a little bit of sort of food ways, concepts there. And it's like, okay, how does their culture influence what they eat looks like? So the goblin food tends to be, in my imagination, have developed out of very portable food that you could take on a military campaign. And even though they don't necessarily do that anymore, that's what the basis of their food still looks like. So that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Was there anything else about, say, the Moot and Acha or Doggy and Ekis, anything else like that I can tell you about?
No, I think you summed it up pretty well. I mean, these were some of the most impressive concepts in the trilogy, and I think they really helped bring the goblin culture to life, and I hope they show up in a source book someday. Let's talk a bit about the villains, which is actually kind of tricky because some of the villains don't get revealed until halfway through the series. But we've got Pradur. Is that how I say it?
Pradur,
the goblin cleric.
Yes.
And what's the name of the bugbear?
Baka.
Baka, yes. Which is the Japanese word for stupid. Oh, Baka.
I did not know that.
Baka. No, okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. Baka with a B is the Japanese word for stupid.
Oh.
Baka.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah.
Baka with an M.
Yeah. Baka. Which sounds like waka waka waka, which is what Fozzie Bear says. Okay. And I think those are the only villains I can reveal without giving away any spoilers.
I'd say so too. Yeah, Pradur is a cleric, and Maka is kind of interesting because he is. The fourth edition came out around the same time as I was. It came out while I was in the middle of the second book, which is partly why Tankus as a tiefling makes an appearance. They came out, and Maka is a paladin under fourth edition rules. He is an evil paladin, and I sort of enjoyed doing that.
That's interesting because I would have interpreted him as an Avenger personally.
I don't think the Avenger rules weren't out. Otherwise, yeah, an Avenger actually would have made sense for him.
Yeah. So I thought to myself, this is an iconic Avenger of the Fury.
Yes, that absolutely would have made sense. But that's what happens, you know, when the new rules appear. It's like, oh, it would have made so much more sense to have him, you know, this way or that way. But anyways, he is what he is for now.
Yeah. Yeah. So among the villains that I have mentioned and the villains that I have not mentioned, who is your favorite villain out of this series?
I have to stop and think about that for a second. I would actually say, you know, I'm going to go with Maka, partly because he grew into the villain that he is. You're actually introduced to him in the first book, and I can't remember now why I didn't think of him later on, but when he reappears, it grew out of the story, and it was a perfect fit, and I thought, oh, this is good. I like, you know, he surprised me, and but it was a natural growth.
Because when you first meet him, he's just sort of a road bump on the hero's path,
yeah.
And you think, oh, okay, right. we're done with him, and then he comes back, and terrorizes the heroes for two more books.
Yeah. So yeah, no, I really liked him. I liked the way he developed. There are a couple of scenes with him in particular. I'm trying to remember. I may have actually ended up cutting a scene that with him that I thought was really, really summed up his character. But it might still be there. I don't want to. It's one of those scenes you don't want to give away. But I also do have a soft spot for Pradur as well, because I think I feel like I sort of underplayed her. Pardon?
I was going to say Pradur is really creepy and gets on your nerves, and you want someone to wring her scrawny little neck, like most of your villains.
That's perfect. Good. With her, I think creepy is a good way to put it. Because again, she appears in a couple of places first before she becomes really part of the story. And I had fun sort of building her up, and I like to think that I left some mystery around her. I'm not spoiling anything by saying that. It's just, you know, there's more to her than is revealed in the story or that is part of the story. So it's sort of a background of the character that exists in my head.
Interesting. I have to say the villain that I most wanted to get it. I can't say his name because it's a spoiler, but it's the one who betrays the party.
Oh yes. Oh good. Okay. Well, I'm glad you wanted him to get it. So that's I will go out on a limb and say him, because there really aren't that many female characters, so I feel safe about that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you liked that, as I had fun with him too. He was a tricky bit to write.
Sorry. He is definitely a little weasel.
Thank you.
Were you going to say more?
I'd love to go into detail about the character, but yeah, it is a spoiler, so I can't.
You're also very good at very creepy adventure settings. One of the things that stands out to me most about the Dragon Below trilogy is when Gesh goes to the haunted castle of Jegesh Dol or something like that.
Jegesh Dol.
With the crawling. Yeah. Yeah, Jegesh Dol with the crawling hands and the ghost of the Dalekir, and here there's a scene in the final book, which really isn't a spoiler, but there's a great scene where they go to another haunted room, just this really wicked, creepy monster. Do you enjoy writing just set piece creepy adventure scenes like that?
Yeah, I do. Every so often when you're writing these things, you get like a really strong picture of, you know, this is what this setting is. And certainly Jegesh Dol was one of them, which is in my sort of like head, the Orcish translation for that is Place of Cuts. And that's just one of my favorite sequences, like in anything I've written. And the runes at the end of, Tyranny of Ghosts was another one where I had a very strong image of this is what I want it to look like. The ruins came into my head and I had the vision of them. It was really the monster that that said, this is what I want. And I had to sort of, it's one of those things you can see it in your head when you're writing
that,
it.
That monster is truly terrifying, and now I want to use that setting in my D&D campaign, even though I don't have stats for that monster. It's definitely very, very inspirational.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about the future. Should you get the opportunity to write another series of novels with these characters, yeah, where would you like to take these characters? Where would you like to go?
I would actually write slightly different characters. Partly because, as I said, I feel like I've wrapped up the stories for at least two of them. I could go on with Ashi. But again, she's sort of reached a point in her life where she's sort of in balance. What I would actually probably do if I was turning back to characters from the books, I have the characters Singe, the Fire Wizard, and Dandra, the Kalashtar. I would like to revisit them. They really sort of took sidelines in the Legacy of Takan. At one point, I had an idea of just writing a throwaway scene or short story showing what they've been up to. In my head, they're off in one of the kingdoms, and they're summoned by the in Ondare, and they're summoned by the Secret Service. Someone's found out what Geth is doing in Dargoon, and they know a connection, and it's like, what do you know about this? But they have, you know, sort of aspects of their stories that I didn't get to explore in The Dragon Below. And I think they would be good characters to pick up. Otherwise, you know, it's difficult sort of to say where I would go with the current characters. there are things to do with them. When I first finished the story, I said, you know, that's it. There's, you know, their stories are done. I might be able to go back to those characters now. Sort of, you know, see where do they go now.
I would definitely like to hear more about Dondra and Kalashtar society, because I think that's something in Eberron that really needs a lot of work, because the Kalashtar don't really see a lot of print. I mean, their story is very important to the Eberron world. They're tied to the Dreaming Dark, and yet no one really knows anything about the Kalashtar. They're not really pushed to the front, so to speak.
They would be a fun ones to write. As you say, they've got their own backstory, and there's sort of these shades of culture that have been filled in here and there. And I would like the challenge of taking that and sort of expanding on it and running with it. Certainly one of the, I think, the best source book for Eberron that I had read was I'm blanking on it again. It's not Secrets of Zendric. It's the
Sarlona,
Secrets of Sarlona, old world of Eberron that the Quarry have conquered.
That was one of the first books that I reviewed for this very podcast, and I seem to remember I gave it a very glowing review because I really liked it also.
Yeah, there's so much potential there. I would love to do something in that, and I know that Keith in the third book of his Dreaming Dark trilogy took his characters mm-hmm. to Sarlona, and unfortunately I haven't read book yet. But I would like to, you know, so I'd see what he did and see what else I could do with that. And I think that would be a really interesting place to go with the characters.
Okay, well, I can't wait to see what's next for the world of Eberron, and I can't wait to see what's next for Don Bassingthwaite. Are you working on any projects right now that you would like to announce?
I've just wrapped up the first book in it's a course setting trilogy. And I'm not doing the whole trilogy, I'm doing the first book, but it's the first of the Abyssal Plague books. And it's called Temple of Yellow Skulls. It comes out next March. And it's sort of a big event. I believe they sort of announced what they could have at Gen Con. And the introduction to the trilogy is already sort of unfolding. James Wyatt has written a novella, The Gates of Madness, and you can pick up parts of those books or parts of that novella through a series of books. And then the Abyssal Plague itself is going to unfold in this core trilogy. It also crosses over into there are two Forgotten Realms books that tie into it and one Dark Sun book that sort of affect this whole storyline, but I get to launch so with the trilogy, so I'm excited.
It's sort of like the Dungeons and Dragons equivalent of the big summer crossover in comic books every year.
Yeah, a little bit like that it is. But you know, as far as I know, worlds don't collapse. There are no Green Lanterns. You know,
there could be, but Green Lanterns. If you, I don't know. There could someone could have a lantern. It could be green.
Can't rule anything out. But sort of the seeds for the story are planted in Bill Slavicek's novel Mark of Nerath, which this is September. It came out last month. So people can pick that up if they want a background, or they can dip into the Gates of Madness. And the first of those, the first installment of that is available for download on the Wizards of the Coast website.
Well, awesome. I can personally say that I'm a big fan of James Wyatt, and I've read a couple chapters of The Gates of Madness, and I can say that it's that so far it's very very interesting. If you're into the Elder Elemental Eye, you'll find it very intriguing. Yes. Thank you for coming on the show, Don. It was great talking to you. Hopefully we will interview you again when you come out with your next big project. We would love to have you back on the show.
I would love to come back. Thanks.
All right. Well, that is episode 151. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums over at gamershavenpodcast.com and call the Tome's Biz line at 919-BIZTOME. That's 919-BIZTOME. With your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes. If you have comments you want to share about Essentials, R.A. Salvatore, Drizzt, or the computer program Master Plan, those are the upcoming episodes for this month, as well as an advice episode. So make sure you call in at 919-BIZTOME. You can also review the show on iTunes and tell people about it. That helps spread the word, helps the show grow, and helps us stop from becoming stagnant and boring. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for things discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air and pay our bills. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 151, Legacy of Dakan of
I'm on the wall.